You're listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with your host, Jay Taylor. If you have a question or comment about today's show, Jay would love to hear from you at 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also send an email to questionsfortaylor@gmail.com. That's questions, the number 4, taylor@gmail.com. Now, back to our program.
Welcome back to Turning Hard Times into Good Times. I am your host, Jay Taylor. Really pleased to have with me John Rubino, once again, an old friend. I've known him for many years. He's really a regular guest on this show. And what's really great about John, not only is his knowledge of the markets, but his willingness to come on. Sometimes, every now and then, when somebody doesn't show up for one reason or another, has to cancel out, John has come to the rescue, and that's always appreciated, but even more so his insights into the market, because he's been around the markets for quite a while, but he's very smart, and he's very well spoken, so he's an easy guest. John, thank you so much for joining me again.
Hey, Jay. Well, thanks. Nice to be back.
You know, you've written an article, How Long Until Inflation Breaks Germany, and I've added to that, and the world, ? You know, I don't know, but this whole idea that Germany, you know, with the German hyperinflation, of course, there have been others, Zimbabwe, Argentina, and some of the South American countries have had these, these hyperinflationary events that seem to come every now and then. But Germany is the one we really think about. It was one, I guess, because Germany was such was and still is a major country in the world, but a power at that time. They experienced this hyperinflation that really led up then, I guess maybe one of the reasons we think about it is it led up to Hitler and World War II. Can you talk about that experience, how it impacted the German people, and how it still impacts the memory of Germans and the German people?
Well, yeah, the inflation that we're experiencing right now is, it's a pretty intense thing for most countries. But for Germany, especially so, because almost alone among the major countries of the world, they've got a hyperinflation in living memory. Mm-hmm. In the 1920s, they created way too much currency. The value of their currency just imploded and prices went straight up. And you've got all these pictures of Germans, burning currency in the furnace to keep warm, or mm-hmm. carting suitcases full or wheelbarrows full to the grocery store to buy bread and milk. So for them, it's an especially big deal, and they've been especially serious about maintaining the value of their currency until pretty recently. If you look at a chart of German interest rates and inflation, you see that for most of that chart, going back decades, they kept interest rates above the inflation rate as a way of maintaining the value of their currency. And then during the euro era, especially since the Great Recession, that's reversed. Now their interest rates are much lower than their inflation rate, and their inflation rate is spiking. So, excessively low interest rates are by definition inflationary. That's what they're for, is to make prices go up. And so Germany's experiencing the beginnings of a fairly dramatic inflation in a culture that's inflation phobic. So this is a big conflict, a big dilemma for them, and it's not clear how they're going to resolve it, because to go back to where they would like to go, which is to have a strong currency with very low inflation, which they assiduously maintain, they would have to break the eurozone, because there's no way that Italy and Greece and some of the other weaker eurozone countries could live in that kind of a monetary regime. On the other hand, to accommodate Italy and Greece and France to an extent, they've got to accept the current inflation as the new reality. And it's not clear that the Germans can do that temperamentally. So they've got a big problem there. And, it'll be interesting to see how it plays out, because, it's not clear what they're going to choose, which they would consider to be the lesser of two evils, a breakup of the eurozone or raging inflation. Mm-hmm. And so for us, it's a serious deal to have prices going up 6% a year. To Germany, it's a cultural crisis. And we'll find out shortly, because they've got a new government coming in. And it looks like a fairly liberal government. It looks like they're liable to choose preservation of the eurozone in an inflationary environment over breaking up the Eurozone to maintain mm-hmm. the value of the old Deutschmark. Mm-hmm. That's one of the many interesting stories right now. There are lots of other interesting stories and scary stories in this inflationary environment, because most of the, for instance, the developing world, for them, that's much more serious, too, to have prices going up, because they have a bigger percentage of their population living right on the edge, where they're just covering food and gas for their car and rent. And so mm-hmm. you make the price of those things go up, and all of a sudden they've got to cut one of them out, and they risk becoming destitute, and then they hit the streets, and then you have civil mm-hmm. unrest and regime change. Mm-hmm. That's what Brazil and Chile and a lot of other countries in that category mm-hmm. are looking at. So this mm-hmm. is a very dramatic time, and in the U.S. we don't completely get how dramatic it is for a lot of other countries.
No, we remember the Great Depression, which was the opposite problem. Of course, mm-hmm. a strong dollar, and so our bias is always towards, I think, inflating and trying to avoid those issues. Although I don't think Keynesian economics is the answer. But if anything, Keynesian economics is leading us down this path towards, I think, inevitable inflation. But one thought that just occurred to me, John, is that 1920. You know, there's not too many people around. There may be a memory of that from the parents and the grandparents, but there's not too many people. So you get this fourth turning, that the book The Fourth Turning. You get four generations or so, and the memories sort of fade, even in Germany, I would guess. And I'm wondering if that might not be part of the reason that Germany is willing to go in this direction, more liberal so-called liberal direction of easy money.
Yeah, that no doubt is a big part of it, because by the time you get to the great grandchild stage mm-hmm. of the cycle, they really don't remember what happened to grandma and grandpa back in the day, even though they hear the stories and everything. So you could make the case that Germany, their culture has shifted to allow them to accept inflation. In a way that no way would they have done that in, the 1960s or 70s, when mm-hmm. there were a lot of people who were adults in decision-making positions who actually remembered the hyperinflation. But yeah, that's probably what makes it possible for them to be in the position that they're in right now. Yet, German culture is still very anti-inflationary. Mm-hmm. And there is that, the guys running the Bundesbank have mm-hmm. always been the dissenters in the European, in the Euro Monetary Union. They've always been the sound money, low inflation guys, whereas the, Mario Draghi and whoever's running the French central bank now, those people have always been way more comfortable with inflation. So to the extent that the new German government and the new bureaucrats they put in place are modern Europeans comfortable with inflation, then it's possible that that's what we end up with. The Eurozone just becomes a very inflationary environment going forward. Mm-hmm. In other words, prices go up at an accelerating rate from where they are now, and they're already very high right now. Europe's going to have an outrageous winter, it looks like, with gas prices way up. And if the weather's colder than usual, this is going to be brutal for a lot of people there.
Well, on your website, dollarcollapse.com, your article, How Long Until Inflation Breaks in Germany, the article also included an excerpt from another, I guess it was from Reuters. Germany's incoming finance minister rings alarm bell on inflation. So I guess, would that be the incoming finance minister from the new government?
Yeah, they're talking about wanting to raise interest rates. Mm-hmm. In the near term. Mm-hmm. And, they face the same pressures we face here with the Fed. When they as soon as they try to do anything like that, the financial markets just collapse and force them to go in the other direction. Mm-hmm. The ECB has, if anything, an even bigger problem, because their economies are weaker and more diverse. In other words, they've got some really weak pockets there that could just blow up. Like, if you forced Italy to live within its means, that would be a catastrophe. They just couldn't do it. So they would probably pull out of the Eurozone, go back to the lira, and the system would start to break up. And the guys running the ECB and the Eurozone know that. They know there's only so much they can do. They want to do what they can, but it's not clear what they can do. See, all the big central banks are in this box now, where mm-hmm. they've allowed things to get so out of hand that trying to rectify things, in other words, trying to go back to normal levels of interest rates, mm-hmm. would just blow up their economies because so much debt has been created, a big part of which has to be rolled over, that if you raise interest rates, that debt rolls over at higher rates, which raises the interest costs for the borrowers, which bankrupts them, and then in turn bankrupts their creditors and so on, and you get this cascade failure of the system. That's what they're looking at. They're either going to have accelerating inflation with all the instability that that implies, or a debt-driven collapse, mm-hmm. which, like you said, in the U.S., we can remember that. Nobody wants to preside over something like that again.
Yeah. Well, you know, it seems to me that there's no turning back once you get beyond a certain point. You know, politically, it's all about kicking the can down the road and breathing a little. You know, it's like being on a respirator, I guess, until the end comes. But yeah, I've got Charles Hugh Smith on my show next week, and he's written an article, Why Inflation is a Runaway Train. I don't know, you may have read that article, I don't know, but I'm going to have him on next week to talk. It just seems to me, you know, I've always been sort of a deflationist, and it seems to me that what we could see is, you know, a little bit too much tightening now, and it triggers, it's almost as if the economy's on a knife's edge, you know, one side or the other is trouble. So if they get too much tightening, just a little bit too much, and because these guys can't really figure out what the collectively what the markets are going to do. They try, you know, this whole Keynesian market theory, the whole idea of being able to, you know, put into a computer the variables that will control society, it's just a little bit arrogant. And I just wonder if you don't think that maybe, you know, we could see some. I mean, I thought, what do you make of Powell's pivot, the latest one here? You know, it's, the market was spooked, it seemed, last week because he was, you know, he was talking about the need to taper more quickly, and it was really hawkish, and the market seemed to be caught off balance by it. But here we go again. I mean, I saw a little while ago the Dow was up 500 points today. You know, the NASDAQ was up 3% or something like that. What do you make of this now? Which way are we? Any comments about Powell's latest pivot?
Well, the almost unprecedented volatility that we've seen in the last week or 10 days is because there's so much extra money sloshing around out there. You know, we increased the money supply, depending on which measure you use, between 20% and 60% in just the last year. We flooded the system with money. It has to go somewhere, but it doesn't know where to go because it doesn't know what's going to happen next. So you see it pouring into stocks and then pouring back out of stocks. You know, if the NASDAQ is up or down by less than 2% in a day now, that's a boring day. You know, it used to be 2% move in the NASDAQ was huge.
It's huge,
now it's
yeah.
nothing. And this kind of action, extreme volatility in both directions, frequently indicates the end of a run. Because now you've got people who are getting increasingly worried that we've gone too far, stocks are overvalued, the Fed is tightening, yada, yada. They want to sell. At the same time, you've got a whole generation of people who have been programmed to buy the dip. So, you know, one day the sellers predominate, the next day the dip buyers predominate, and you get these gigantic moves. And this kind of thing happened in the last cycle in 2007. Uh-huh. And then it was resolved by a gigantic crash. And it's completely possible that that happens again, that this kind of volatility resolves into one-directional volatility. In other words, it's volatile, but it's mostly to the downside. Mm-hmm. And especially if the Fed is going to do anything, see, they're just talking right now, but if they actually do any kind of tightening, then we are back in 2008 range where the whole system starts to blow up. And you got so many bubbles out there that there's no way even to guess which bubble will burst first. You know, it could be the housing bubble again. It could be cryptos. It could be, you know, decentralized finance that are related to cryptos. Could be tech stocks, emerging markets. It goes on and on, you know.
Yeah.
It could be the bond market like Michael Pinto is predicting. Mm-hmm. But something will blow up and then it'll knock down the other dominoes. And we'll have a crash that makes 2008-2009 look like the good old days. And that's a completely possible scenario. And another one is that the Fed caves immediately, starts liquefying the system even more, and financial assets just take off again. You know, that's also possible.
Yeah, financial assets take off, and the rich get richer, and the middle class keeps shrinking, and that's the way we go. But in terms of why money doesn't know where to go. I would submit that it has everything to do with the manipulation of interest rates. You know, if money, if the price of money were allowed to be discovered by the market, that would allocate where money goes. But it's not allowed to, right? We're not allowed. They can't allow the markets to determine what the real price of capital is.
Yeah. Well, you could put it a slightly different way also, that we're artificially depressing interest rates.
Mm-hmm.
And so money knows what to do when interest rates are low. That's a signal, you know.
Right.
When interest rates are artificially low, that's a signal to borrow a bunch of money.
Right.
And then throw it at whatever's hot.
Right.
So you get all these bubbles. And so the capital markets are reacting correctly in the moment to the incentive structure that the Fed has created, but it's an artificial incentive structure that can't last because it creates so many imbalances. That it only takes one imbalance, you know, one mini bubble to blow up all the other bubbles. And we're kind of there now. And that's a big part of the fear that's out there in the markets right now, is that this could very easily be the end of the latest bubble cycle. And since it's by far the biggest bubble market that's ever existed, it could be the end of the debt super cycle that started after World War II. Which I kind of tend to think it might be. Charles Hugh Smith had another article about that, about how all the big cycles have shifted in a different direction now. Mm-hmm. In other words, interest rates have been going down, 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 down forever. Now they're plateauing and starting to go back up. The balance between labor and capital has been all capital for the last 40 years, which has impoverished labor. Well, now labor, there's a shortage, and they're striking and getting much higher wages. And so the cycle is shifting the other way. In other words, workers are starting to get more of the corporate profits that are being generated than the owners are, which means corporations are going to be less profitable going forward, which means stocks obviously aren't quite as attractive as they would have been otherwise. And so there are a lot of other cycles like that that have all shifted in a different direction, and all of them point in directions that are bad for financial asset prices.
Mm-hmm.
So this massive shift in long waves, it's kind of, you could call it the Kondratiev wave or the fourth turning, or, you know, all the long wave theories say that we're right at the end. You know, they all have different terminology.
Yeah.
They all have different time frames in a lot of cases, but all of them basically say the same thing, that we are royally screwed at the moment, you know, that we're heading into their version of winter. And the numbers kind of that way.
Yeah. You just have to wonder what, you know, I mean, equities should be priced so that it makes some kind of a reasonable return, you know, between dividends and retained earnings, you know, after-tax earnings, that shareholders should be rewarded. There should be some kind of a meaningful return. But what is that meaningful return when capital is not allowed to be discovered? The price of capital is not allowed to be discovered because of the manipulation you talked about. And then the thing is, all this easy money seems to be fueling inflation. But inflation, as you just pointed out, in financial markets have become overpriced, and they're way beyond what their intrinsic value is. So at some point, you have to think that this sort of good inflation that goes into financial assets, which is the way at least the ruling elite looks at it, it's got to come to an end. It's just Mother Nature is going to have its way eventually, I would think, John. But then these major turns come, and then if we're positioned right, they can actually work to your benefit. And that's what we're trying to do on this show, is to help people and to position ourselves so that, when the hard times come, that we're positioned at least to survive and hopefully be able to help our families and our loved ones when that comes. So I mentioned to you an article, I don't know if you had a chance to read it, by Tom Luongo. Davos is making the central bank case for gold. You by chance have a chance to look at that, John?
The Basel III rules,
right,
and the reaction of a lot of governments to them make gold a lot more attractive. They,
mm-hmm.
they make gold a more important asset for central banks to own. And a lot of the European banks, see, the Asian banks have always been buying gold. India and Russia and China. They've been accumulating.
I guess we should say physical gold. As opposed to derivative gold or paper gold. As I understand it, Basel III makes it not profitable for banks to have a bunch of those gold derivatives on their books or silver derivatives.
Yeah. If they're going to trade in gold, they have to do it for real instead of in the paper market.
Right.
And that's theoretically going to chase a lot of the banks out of that market, which means there will be less manipulation going on. So there won't be as much artificial depression of the price of gold going forward. At least that's the theory. Okay, I'll take it. You know, an honest gold market would have gold at $5,000 an ounce right now. Mm-hmm. And it could be that that's what we're building. Although, I got to say, it's hard to imagine the power structure doing something that takes away so much of their power voluntarily. Mm-hmm. You know, I keep waiting for did you think we were going to do that? No, we're going to, you know. And so this is one of those, I'll believe it when I see it things, because it's so out of character for these people to actually give up power. But we'll see.
Well, I believe that's right. But I think also that there could be geopolitical factors in play here. We take for granted that the Europeans and the U.S. they were always going to be in, you know, lubby-dubby. But it isn't necessarily so, I suspect. You know, there seems to be some fissures already between us that are cropping up, and part of what Tom Luongo was saying has to do with exactly that. The Europeans are not able to reflate as easily as the U.S. can. I don't understand exactly the mechanics of it, but as I understand, individual European countries send their exchange their debt instruments for euros. And so, you know, countries can create money, but he makes the argument that it's going to be in the European bank's interest to start holding physical gold as opposed to, you know, they can't hold the paper gold, and that the European, that the euro is likely to come under some pressure, and in order to defend the euro, it's going to have to bulk up its balance sheets with real physical gold. The banks are. I don't know if time will tell, but he makes the case that Davos is unwittingly. He would agree with you. They're not. The powers that be aren't interested in going to honest money. They have the dishonest thing working for them very well, in terms of gaining power and enriching themselves. So why would they ever want to do that? And I think the answer is they wouldn't unless certain parts of the global economy, have an interest in doing that, and other parts don't. But I don't know. We shall see, as you say. And that Basel III goes into effect early, I think, the first business day of January for Europe, or for London anyway, the LBMA.
Well, that just adds to the sense that 2022 is going to be a really fascinating year, doesn't it? There's an awful lot of stuff that's coming to a head, it feels like, and that's going to be the year when it happens. So add all the geopolitical stuff to the financial stuff, and what a year is coming up, a very scary one, because we've already got Russia and China sensing U.S. weakness and apparently getting ready to resolve some stuff in their neighborhood that they couldn't get away with before, you know, take back Taiwan, neutralize Ukraine. And that right there would be enough to cause a gigantic financial crisis if we have some kind of an almost shooting war.
No, let's hope not.
My God.
Let's hope and pray not. Well, I'd just like to tell people it's dollarcollapse.com. Go there to read any number of great articles that John Rice and other people write. Here's the emerging alt economy, Buy Nothing. The one thing that John wrote on November 21st. John, anything else you'd like to say before we say goodbye today?
Well, yeah, Jay, I would like to expand on what you said a minute ago about how this is actually an investment thesis, all this gloom and doom stuff. You know, this kind of change creates a lot of opportunities. Mm-hmm. And what we should be doing, instead of just lamenting the fact that our world is going crazy, we should be thinking about how we make money from this and how we protect our families. And your newsletter is a great place to start. The junior gold miners and silver miners are eventually going to be like the dot-coms of this cycle, or the cryptocurrencies of the next cycle, you know, where they go way up. And so,
I agree.
You know, that's our chance.
All right. All right. Thank you. We'll have to leave it at that. I agree with you, of course, and I think our time is very close at hand. But we do have to leave it go. Next week, I'm going to have Quentin Henning with me to talk about El Oro Resources, and Charles Hugh Smith, as I said, will be with us to talk about why inflation is a runaway train. Until then, goodbye, and God's blessings to you.
Thank you again for listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with Jay Taylor. Please join us again next Tuesday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Business Channel.
Labrador Gold is an exploration company focused on its flagship Kingsway project, located in central Newfoundland Gold District. Labrador Gold's first phase drilling program has successfully identified high-grade gold mineralization, including a 3.6-meter intercept, grading 20.6 grams per ton gold, and 1.85 meters, grading 50.38 gram per ton gold. The company has approximately $35 million in the treasury and is led by a world-class team of CEO Roger Moss and technical advisors Sean Ryan and Quentin Henney.